When Erin was 26 years old, she was working in New York City, and she'd finally had enough.
I worked for a religious organization of higher education as a residence hall manager of a dorm, and they dictated my life. They told me when I could take off work, when I could not, when I had to be working, even if it was overnight hours. They told me that I couldn't have too much cleavage. They documented me for not ironing a shirt and told me that I wasn't allowed to use free speech, basically, at all for the job.
So Erin did what all of us have fantasized about doing at one point or another in our adult lives. She rage quit.
I decided that I was going to write a very detailed and bulleted line item list of resignation, and I handed it onto the desk of the president of the institution, the dean of student affairs, who was my boss's boss, my boss, all of my coworkers. It was overnight. I had keys to all the buildings, so I just went in and put it on everybody's desk and waited. So it was not taken well.
So looking back on it, this was a decade ago. Are you proud of that move? Are you regretful? What goes through your mind when you think about rage quitting 10 years ago?
I am so proud of it. I would do it again in a heartbeat. It was an abusive situation, and I don't think anyone should ever work in an abusive situation. I would still do it, knowing what I know now, that I did it during the worst financial crisis of many years. I struggled, but I came out on top of it. And so, yes, I would totally do it again. I thought it was the most professional I could be while my blood was boiling. All I wanted to do was give a big middle finger.
Erin's situation was unique, and it worked out for her at that time. As for giving advice to others who may be thinking of walking away,
I say, go do it. As long as you have a good social circle of support that won't judge you and will be there for a couch or a meal when you need it, go for it.
There you go. Go for it. Rage quitting and other tales of walking away. That's tonight on Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Yes, thanks, Erin. Welcome to Extension 720 on WGN Radio. I am Justin Kaufman. Tonight, we've got a great program lined up for you to keep you company on this Friday night. We're exploring the idea of walking away. It's loose, but the segments tonight all have that theme in common. Take, for instance, a download on Chicago business, which makes its debut on Extension 720 later this hour. We've talked to several entrepreneurs over the years about their success stories, but sometimes it's not about starting up, but walking away. Serial entrepreneur Pete Cadence did just that, retired at the age of 40. We'll talk about the art of cashing out. Also tonight, author Cory Doctorow live in studio, the famed writer and editor of Boing Boing, is one of America's best futurist writers. He's written a book, actually four books in one, that imagines a distant time where technology and our digital world betray us. Also, except in this case, his stories are so real that they take place 500 years from now, but it feels like 500 days. Also, we continue our neighborhood tour tonight, Chatham. Chatham saw their beloved Target walk away from the neighborhood last year, so what does that mean for the stability of the once stable Southside middle-class black community? In an interview and live performance with singer-songwriter Glenn Phillips, the frontman for Toad the Wet Sprocket is at Old Town School tonight. We talk about his new solo work, which, you guessed it, shares tonight's theme. How can you walk away from this show? It's Extension 720. Stay with us. That's the theme tonight, walking away. 312-981-7200 if you want to join the program. Let's talk about walking away. There's a lot to walk away from these days. Just today, maybe you want to walk away from the Mueller report spin. We haven't seen it yet, but that hasn't stopped everyone telling us what's in it. Or maybe you want to walk away from your favorite team's performance in the tournament. What happened, Wisconsin? Or maybe your favorite team's coach, Michigan State. It's time. It's time. Or maybe just like Erin, you're fed up. But can you even walk away anymore? seems like something you could do in a Doctor O novel or maybe a dreamy indie film, but now we've built worlds around us that follow us wherever we go. You break up with a girlfriend or boyfriend, you can't walk away. You Facebook stalk instead. And with the internet, data follows you wherever you go. You rage quit that job? I dare you, because I'm sure your next employer will know about it, probably before you even apply. So maybe walking away isn't really about giving it up or lighting your last life on fire. Sometimes you have to walk away. I get it. Sometimes your life depends on it. Abuse, addiction, toxic relationships. You're left with no other choice. But there's walking away from something you love when you just can't do it anymore. More like retirement. You walk away head high, knowing you did your best in whatever you were trying to be the best at. It's not about running or hiding, but it's about letting the world know what you've accomplished. Or if I could describe it in one word, Ichiro. Ichiro Suzuki walked away this week. The Hall of Famer was the Hall of Famer to be, set records in two different leagues in two different continents. He said he wanted to play Major League Baseball till he was 50 years old, but he's 45, and the physical limitations of growing older have prohibited him from doing so. But watching how Japan reacted to his retirement this week, playing in front of his home country, it's hard not to get teary-eyed. Their prodigal son, their national hero, returned for one last curtain call. It is what makes sport great. I read this great piece in FanGraphs about Ichiro. The writer, Rachel McDaniel, said this about him and why sport in general matters. She said, "Many bad things could happen to baseball, and it could survive. But if, for some reason, we lost the ability to find joy in it, the game would be worthless. There would be no point in working your whole life to make the big leagues if, upon arriving, no one cared. If no one saw and acknowledged the magnitude of what you've done, if there was no moment of recognition, looking into the stands as a player who worked your entire life to stand in this spot, or looking onto the field as someone who has never played or used to play or just beginning to play, and seeing yourself, somehow, the parts of yourself that you want others to see, the possibility of what you could be, reflected right back to you. There are a few players in the history of organized baseball who have brought this joy to more people, spanning continents, crossing decades, than Ichiro." Ichiro Suzuki walked away this week. Thanks for the joy.
There's nothing more for us to say. Got my mind made up, I'm walking away. Sometimes we just outgrow the road that we play. Hope you find a happy ending to your story someday. There's nothing more for us to say. Got my mind made up, I'm walking away. Sometimes we just outgrow the role that we play. Hope you find a happy ending to your story someday.
As every Extension 720, Andrea Darlis joins us. Andrea, have you ever rage quit anything?
I've never rage quit. I have not. I wanted to, you know, when I was on the softball team in 7th and 8th grade, and I love the sport. I just wasn't great at it. I wanted to quit and walk away, and my dad said, no, you're not going to walk away. You're going to finish. You don't quit on your teammates. It's interesting you mentioned sport, though, because when you talk about walking away like Ichiro, remember Annika Sorenstam?
Yeah.
She was the number 2 ranked golfer in the world. And walked away.
Walked away.
Walked away at the age of 37. She could have played for 30 more years if she wanted, but she said at the time, Justin, she had just gotten married and she wanted to have kids and focus on her foundation, the Annika Foundation, which has provided scholarships and golf clubs and equipment and clothing to children in need all over the world. So she went on to do wonderful, great, great things and is just very non-self-serving. And your guest earlier, who...
Yeah, Aaron,
you know,
right?
Good, I want to say good for her in so many ways, because you know what? She wasn't happy and somebody else was kind of controlling her destiny and controlling her fate. So I hear and cheers to her for having the courage to do that.
To do that. You know, it's funny because there was an article this week and it kind of started the ball rolling on this theme about millennials and rage quitting.
Yeah.
This is a new thing. And there's a show that's a brilliant show on Hulu called Shrill with A.D. Bryant. That is getting great reviews right now, and that's a component of the show. But it made this article happen. They talked about it, and more people talked about throwing their hands up or being dramatic when they quit because they couldn't stand their job.
Right.
So it's fascinating to think about that. And you're right. I think a lot of people fantasize about walking away, but actually doing is another story.
Absolutely. I think it takes a lot of heart. It takes a lot of courage. And only now, as I am older, I could see why Annika Sorenstam did it, because there are things, you know, you have to be happy in your job. You have to be happy in your life. And family, personal life, it's the most important thing in the world. Quality of life becomes so much more important as you get older.
That's a great promo for what's coming up in the Download in Chicago Business. We'll talk with Pete Cadence, who's just in early retirement at the age of 40. And a lot of the things you just said was the reasons that he pointed to get out of being a serial entrepreneur. So we'll have that conversation coming up after 7:30. It's Extension 720. We're with you. 312-981-7200. Don't walk away. Glenn Phillips, the front man for Toad the Wet Sprocket. He's in studio tonight. He's got a new solo record, and this is a new song. It's called Fever. We'll catch up with him with an interview later, but here is Glenn Phillips.
With the shrug of her shoulders, the mountain came down, tore a path all the way to the water, and through my sleeping town. And the trails I wandered all erased in the birth of the million-year-old rock from the naked gasping earth. Oh, my children, where you gonna go? Now you've lost the land you called your home. And the earth is burning, fever on her brow, crying, oh my children, who can save you now? Now the winters hit harder, the summers are fire, and the rains are the tears of a mother for a rebellious, reckless child. But still the spring brings clover amid the blackened oaks, the sprays of fledgling branches and the wild flowers below. Oh, my children, where you gonna go? Now you've lost the land you called your home. And the earth is burning, fever on her brow, crying, oh my children, who will save you now? Oh my children, oh my children, who can save you now? Chaos is my lover, fate is my bride. We will meet at the edge of the water and the ever-rising tide.
There you go, Glenn Phillips, yes. Front man from Toad the Wet Sprocket in studio tonight. We're going to talk with him coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. He's got a brand new solo record, and he is at Old Town School of Folk Music tonight. Glenn Phillips. Oh, man. It's amazing to think about. Toad the Wet Sprocket is celebrating 30 years. They got a summer tour coming around. Should be coming through Chicago this summer, but amazing to think about that band, which has been kind of off the radar for a couple of years, but amazing to think that that band is celebrating 30 years. We'll talk with Glenn coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Wanted to just get to the text line real quick, 773. I rage quit after years of verbal abuse. I walked up to my boss. I said, I'm done. I took my baseball hat off and threw it in the dirt in front of her. Right. Sounds very like an umpire, like a Billy Martin scene from a late Yankees 1977 yeah. team. But
a
there
Larry
you go.
Boa scene, right?
Yeah, there you go. So keep them coming. 312-981-7200. It's extension 720 here on 720 WGN.
It's business time.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it's time for the Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is our weekly segment that talks with local CEOs and entrepreneurs. They tell their stories so we can better understand ours. Part of being an entrepreneur is knowing when to expand, to push through, but it's also knowing when to walk away. Pete Cadence was a serial entrepreneur. First, it was an outsourced sales firm in Evanston. Then he struck gold with a solar energy company in Chicago. Then he rode the wave that was medical marijuana, taking the company GTI public on the Canadian Stock Exchange. That company, by the way, is a $3 billion company today. Then just at this fall, at the wise old age of 40, Pete walked away. Cadence made business headlines when he decided to retire early, and he is my guest tonight on the Download on Chicago Business. Pete, good to see you.
You too. Thank you, Justin.
This, you did the op-ed in Cranes when you made this decision back this fall, and you know you explained a lot of it really came from your family, but talk about why you walked away.
Well, I think that the hallmark of a great entrepreneur is that, you know, not necessarily that they, you know, make the most money or that they have the most employees, but actually that they're self-aware enough to know when they're not fulfilled any longer. And the truth was is that I was waking up each morning and something wasn't fulfilling, something wasn't gratifying. And when I really looked at it, what it was effectively relationship poverty. I was relationship poor. And the people who I wanted to create relationship wealth with were my wife and my three kids and my family and my network of friends too. And I just didn't have any time for them.
Now you hear that all the time.
You
hear it from CEOs, from professional sports players. People say, I just want to spend more time with my family. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a cliche.
But I said that, but I said it in a different way and I meant it. I said, I didn't leave for my family. I left for myself. As selfish as that may sound. Because while I was busy chasing fame and money and prestige, I forgot about chasing memories. And I look back and I say, I missed out on all these amazing things. And selfishly, I wanted to be a part of them. I wanted to be with my family. I wanted to be relationship wealthy. I wanted to have a great marriage. I wanted all these things. And they seemed to be, in the scheme of things, more important. And also, I think when you're a busy entrepreneur, and like me, I was on the road 150 nights a year, you know, I probably wasn't going to live to 60 at my current pace.
Right.
And so a lot of this is the last thing that I focused on was my own personal well-being. I mean, my blood pressure is down 50 points. I'm down 20 pounds. I'm swimming 3 miles a week. I'm getting a focus on my health, wealth, and health and well-being. And you know, I want to be around for my kids.
Now, a lot of this is not like we heard Erin earlier where she's like, I'm rage quitting. I'm getting out.
Yeah.
You still, when you get out as a CEO, especially the company that you were at with GTI, there's money attached to that get out. You're well off in doing so. You just decided to retire early. You know, in the op-ed, you talked about a situation that happened to you with your kids where, as you said, you travel a lot. And this one time, you came home.
Yeah. I came home and, normally when I would come home, my kids would greet me at the door. When the door opened and the alarm buzzed, they'd at least acknowledge me. And in this particular time, I'd been gone for roughly a week. It was kind of a heavy travel week. And it was a Saturday morning, so my kids were all home and they didn't even move a muscle. They didn't look at me. And I of course, didn't say anything to my children because I didn't think they would understand. But I said something to my wife and I really felt this overwhelming sense of guilt that, you know, here they're growing up and they're kind of leaving me behind. I wasn't a material part of their upbringing anymore.
You are a tremendous entrepreneur, and as I mentioned, the jobs you've had in the last, or the companies you've had in the last 15 years. Yeah. But you know, if other CEOs are listening to this and people who are serial entrepreneurs who are starting startups, the message they get from their peers, from guys like Pete Cadence, is you got to get the nose to the grind so nothing else matters. You got to get your company up and running. It's going to be hell. You're going to be working 90 hours a week, but you have to do it.
Well, What was interesting is that the op-ed I wrote in Cranes ended up being one of the most well-read pieces in Cranes all year. In fact, there were more views on that op-ed than there were on the announcement that Rahm Emanuel was leaving office and not running for office again.
Why do you think that was?
I think because it touched a nerve. And I know it touched a nerve because I literally got thousands and thousands of emails, text messages, LinkedIn messages, Facebook messages from people all over the world who connected with what I was saying, who felt my pain, who felt the exact same thing, and it inspired them to think maybe a little bit differently, or maybe even in some case, quit their job. I mean, yeah, look, being a CEO is hard. There is no such thing as balance. That whenever I hear, you know, someone up at a speaking event and they talk about the key to being a great CEO is balance, nonsense. It's not possible. Not in this day and age with our phones and everything we have access to. And so, to be honest, the only way I thought I could find balance mm-hmm. was to actually cold turkey leave.
I would think, and I don't know much about the world of entrepreneurship in Chicago. I learned through these conversations, but I would think that the whole concept is around an ecosystem in a cycle where you are making money and investing that into the next company. Then you make more money from that company and you invest into the next company. So there's almost no way out. Right. I mean, when you think about it, if your end game, so you really have to adjust your goal. How hard is it for someone with your mindset to adjust the end goal?
Well, you know, so that is kind of the way I looked at it. When I started my first company when I was 24. So luckily I started young. And you know, my first company, using a baseball analogy, was like a single. And then my solar energy company was like a double rounding to third. And my third company was a grand slam. And the truth is that at some point enough is enough. Now, some people wake up and there's a certain dollar amount that they thought about they wanted to have in their bank account or whatever, and then they hit that number, and then the next thing, and they want to double that again. And I never was motivated by money. I mean, I certainly liked making money. I was motivated by fulfillment and by camaraderie and by relationships. And so once I got to the point of creating some wealth for my family, I kind of said I'd rather be focused more on philanthropy and family, and that's what would be more. I don't need to take it to the next level. I don't need to hit another grand slam.
But is that cycle, especially quitting cold turkey, and I would think it's addictive. I would think that being an entrepreneur is addictive.
I as I said in my op-ed piece at Cranes, I was an addict, and you know, people say to me all the time, I can't wait until you're going to be a CEO again in 3 months. And well, it's been 8 months, so they were already wrong. And I said, you know, like, I want to be a CEO again. There's no question about it. Of course I do. Every day, practically, I wake up with a new idea, and I'm like, oh, I should start this, be the CEO. But the problem is that I can't be a CEO again for the same reason I quit drinking 11 years ago. You know, it's the same type of addiction. I wasn't addicted to alcohol. I just thought it was better for my health to not drink. But I gave it up cold turkey. This was an addiction. I lived to work. And personally, for me, not necessarily for everybody else, for me, that was unhealthy.
You see this a lot with very successful CEOs where they will leave in their wake. They will be sitting in their penthouse with their really, really young wife or really or a husband.
I do
in this
have
case,
a young, beautiful wife.
But the point being that they've been through marriage after marriage after marriage and have really sort of sacrificed their social life and their social family for the good of their company and their wealth.
Look. I have a beautiful wife who's a great mother. We've known each other for 37 years, and I've been married for 11, and I'm hoping for another 50 or 60 or 80. And that's one of the reasons. Like, I wanted to invest more deeply in my marriage and in my wife and in my family, and I hadn't invested enough. You know, I the one thing about being a CEO is what the people don't understand, I think, is that, you know, being a CEO is as much about being a business executive and making strategic decisions mm-hmm. as it is about being a shrink. I mean, I literally took on all of the drama and the challenges and the trauma that my employees were dealing with, and I helped them adjust because I had to get them, I had to get them on the straight and narrow so they could be working efficiently and effectively. And what ends up happening is their challenges end up taking so much of your mind share that you actually can't focus your mind and your brain on the challenges of your own family. And that's kind of when my family had challenges. My marriage, you know, was a good marriage, but wasn't perfect. I had things I needed to work on at home, but I wasn't doing that because I was so, my mind was so focused elsewhere.
Does it, and I want to, we'll take a break here and I want to come back and talk about specifically your last company. But as I mentioned in the intro, this is a $3 billion company. The company has grown even in the 8 months you've been gone.
It's insane.
The industry, is that hard to see as someone who was at the helm of this company growing? I mean, you cashed out and you cashed out well, but the point being that it continues to grow.
You know, I'm still the second largest shareholder of the company, so I'm still materially invested in their well-being and what they do. I love my partners. I love the people I built the business with. And you know what? And my wife has always been curious about how I can walk. I've walked away from three companies now, three companies that I founded or co-founded. My wife is like always wondered, how can you do that without worrying about the ramifications or having any regrets? And I got to tell you, I don't know if it's the way I'm wired or what, but never once have I walked away from any of the three companies I've started and had any regrets.
You've had a tremendous amount of success, and I want to get into this because, you know, the solar energy company, you were able to get that, that was bought by a big power company. The GTI here has grown and gone public. What is the secret when you're, you know, because you're not actually, you're not, it's not nuts and bolts. It's not making a great product that people are like, oh, this is amazing. I love what Pete Cadence made. You're almost in a way marketing guy. So how, what is the secret when you're running these startups and getting to a point where people want to buy you?
Right. What I always found is, and I've said this a million times, is that corporate culture eats corporate strategy for breakfast 7 days a week and twice on Sunday. That if you get a bunch of smart people in the room and you don't care who gets the credit and you're all committed to winning and you're all committed to having fun in the process and people like showing up to work every day and they feel like they're treated with dignity and respect, I don't care what you're selling. I don't care if it's a widget. I don't care if it's cannabis. I don't care if it's, you know, liquid gold. You'll find a way to have success. And that has always been my theory. I have had fun. I've engaged people. I think I've been a good manager. And I've really focused on meeting my colleagues where they're at. And that's the key. When you're a good, when you're a good CEO, you're a chameleon. You're constantly bobbing and weaving from one person to the next and paying attention to how they work best. And I think that that's what I was pretty competent at.
Pete Cadence is my guest. He walked away. Serial entrepreneur. But he announced his early retirement from the company GTI, Green Thumb Industries, back in the fall. There's a big piece in Cranes about it. We'll continue the conversation here on the Download in Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. Pete Cadence on Extension 720. Stay with us.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time. I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
Ooh. It is the Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. You're on Extension 720. I'm Justin Coffin. Pete Cadence in studio with me. He is an entrepreneur. He was the former CEO of GTI, which is a cannabis company, medical marijuana. And this past fall, he walked away. He early retired at the age of 40, and he is my guest in the studio. As we talk about, you know, this segment has been a segment where, and you've been on this before, just this idea of you know, lessons and learning what it, you know, from one entrepreneur to another, or understanding what the going through their mind. But you never, ever hear about it ending. You never, no entrepreneur has ever been in here with their business and talked about walking away. It's just not part of the vernacular.
Right. And I think that it's, frankly, something that people need to get more comfortable talking about. Again, you know, at what point is enough enough? It is hard. I mean, as I've said a number of times, like, you know, you get addicted to people wanting to interview you and to being in the media. And I was on the cover of Cranes six times over my career. You know, for me, that made me feel good. But as my life transitioned, as I had three children, and as I worked on my philanthropy, stuff like that started becoming less and less important to me. While I still have an ego, and there's no doubt, and I tried to be very rigorously honest with myself, you know, I don't care as much about being recognized, and I don't care as much about being famous. And frankly, I want to be a little bit more private. In fact, if you remember correctly,
yeah, you said no.
I said no. I don't want this to be a media story. I wrote that op-ed in Crain's as a cathartic thing for myself, and it turned out that it went viral. That's not what I intended. So I did this for myself, and I frankly wish that in this day and age that more people, more executives, did things for themselves.
You know, I don't want to get too heady and financial here, but walking away is not really part of the capitalistic plan.
Yeah.
When you talk about capitalism and you talk about being your own boss and your own companies, the goal is to continue. The goal is to accumulate wealth. That right. is the system we live in.
Right.
So you're when you say, I wish more people would do it, that's not part of the plan.
But there's a lot of different permutations of wealth. Wealth isn't necessarily just what's in your bank account. I mean, yeah, I had to feel secure from a financial perspective that I could live the life I want to live, go on the vacations I want to go on, send my kids to college, you know. But there are different permutations of wealth, as I talked about, and one of those is relationship wealth, you know, or you know, the wealth of fulfillment, or the wealth of, you know, the gratification and the wealth of helping others. And those are the things I felt that I was poor in those areas. And so I had to analyze the different permutations of wealth, not just the wealth of means and what was in my bank account. And that's what I really did. And I think if a lot of executives, you know, being a CEO is an extraordinarily lonely job. You don't have a lot of people to talk to. When I was a CEO, it was tough to talk to my wife. She didn't understand the stuff I was going through. It's tough to talk to your employees because you can't tell them a lot of stuff. A lot of it's confidential, and if you worry them, maybe they'll leave. So all of a sudden, you find yourself in this ivory tower, very isolated with no one to talk to. It's a pretty difficult position to be in, and I wanted to talk to people. I wanted to have quality relationships, and I just didn't.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I would think that a lot of CEOs and executives, they find that kind of solace or that warmth and that companionship in other CEOs. And you talked about people, thousands of people reaching out to you, and that article obviously going viral. How much pushback did you get? How much from your friends were like, no, this is not part of the plan?
Yeah, I mean, I do have a crew of Chicago CEO buddies, and I was just named a Henry Crown Fellow of the Aspen Institute, so I'm going to inherit another 20 amazing fellow CEOs as friends starting here in August. And that was an important network. Al Goldstein here in Chicago, Robbie Nathan, Matt Matros, these are just some of my best friends who started great businesses in Chicago, and we were able to talk openly and honestly. But yeah, you know, other than that, man, it was very, very tricky to talk to people honestly about the way I was feeling, and I felt on an island oftentimes.
You know, I think about you, and I think about the ecosystem that is Chicago startup community, and you have lived through it, and yep. You are now on the other side of it, not unlike a retired professional sports player who sits at the desk. What do you think of it? What do you think of is it prime for takeover? Is it still as lucrative and fertile as it once was when you were running solar energy companies?
You mean the entrepreneurial ecosystem here in Chicago? Yeah, I think the entrepreneurial ecosystem in Chicago is incredible. You know, the one beautiful thing about Chicago is if you pick up the phone and you call someone, you know, and you want help, they will help you. Chicago is there's a high degree of camaraderie. There's a willingness to help others. And so I think that it's a great community. The one thing that I don't like, and that I will make sure that I don't do, is that I have seen a number of Chicago entrepreneurs become successful, and then what do? They leave. Now, some of it is they don't like the tax regime here, so they want to be in Florida. Some of it is they don't like the climate here, so they want to be in California. But whatever it may be, I have committed that I am going to continue to work and donate my time, energy, and resources in this community, both to the entrepreneurial community as well as to the impoverished community and other communities, because I feel like I can't abandon the community, the city that gave me so much. This city and its broad shoulders lifted me up. I can't leave. Yeah. Would I like the Florida tax regime with no state income tax? Of course I would. But I don't think that's in the cards for me because I feel like I have a moral imperative and obligation to stay here and give back.
You hear a lot of people who say, you know, because of Illinois' tax regime, as you talk about, people are leaving in droves, the business. And you had a governor in the last 4 years that was talking about that, and even the governor now. But you recognize, and I've heard this before, and the reason I pick it up here in these conversations, is there are some states that just are, it doesn't matter if you can't be competitive. You can't be competitive with no sales tax with Florida. There are some states when, so sometimes that's misleading when people say they're leaving the state of Illinois because of its tax regime, because truly they're going to somewhere where it is, there's just, you can't even compete with it.
Well, look, I had a guy tell me the other day that he was allergic to a fellow CEO said he was allergic to taxes. And I said, why? You know, because I, you know, look, I don't want the IRS to come tax me, you know, two times more than they're already going to tax me. But, you know, I am not allergic to taxes. I feel like it's part of a civic duty that we have. I mean, we see the homeless people on our streets. We see infrastructure crumbling. We see the school systems here struggling and kids having to walk through gang lines to get to school. It is our civic duty. I have always said to everyone in my orbit, to those who much is given, much is expected. And I feel like I have been very fortunate, and I have an expectation by society, by the city of Chicago, to give back. And if that means I'm going to be taxed in the process, so be it. So I'm not one of these people who spends a lot of time pining and trying to circumnavigate, you know, how to pay taxes and trying to figure out nuanced ways to get around it. I don't care. I will pay my civic duty. I will pay my taxes because I think I have an obligation to do so. And so I'm not leaving Illinois for that.
So when are you coming back? When's the next
WGN?
When's this next startup?
Oh, no, you know, no. So my next startups will be poverty and education-related startups. I've started an initiative called the Hope Initiative, helping our population educate in my hometown of Toledo, Ohio. $125 million initiative to make sure that every kid who goes to public school can get to college.
That's great. Pete Cadence in studio tonight, my guest in the Download Chicago Business. Pete, thanks for being here, man.
Thank you, Justin. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Andrea. Extension 720 here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. 312-981-7200, the phone number if you'd like to chime in. Tonight's theme, walking away. Heard stories about rage quitting in the first hour. And, of course, from our serial entrepreneur, Pete Cadence, who was just in studio, who gave it up and walked away at the age of 40. So we'll continue that theme tonight. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to talk. We're going to continue our tour of Chicago neighborhoods before the election. We're going to be in Chatham. Talking with Kathy Cheney, where they had a Target, very, very big news story. A Target left Cottage Grove just on a whim. So Target walked away from Chatham. They're mad about that. I would be mad about it, too. As Kathy mentions in the interview, imagine if that happened to you in your community. I know it seems frivolous, but for listeners who are out there listening, if it's a big box store, the Target or the Mariano's or the grocery store just packed up and left. And there was no plan to replace it, that would tick you off. So we'll talk with Kathy coming up. And also Glenn Phillips from Toad the Wet Sprocket at Old Town School of Folk Music tonight. We will hear from him and some more live music in studio. My guest tonight in the 8 o'clock hour, quickly becoming, if he isn't already, the most prolific futurist author of our time. Cory Doctorow writes dystopian fiction, I guess is the way to call it that. I'm sure he would say maybe not. But it's not just about post-apocalyptic scribes from a distant and unimaginable time. His stories always deal with technology and our digital world. And like I said earlier, the story could be set 500 years ago, but also tomorrow. It could be any which way. But for all the gloom and doom surrounding how our smart world will enslave us, Doctorow's writing centers around humanity, which ultimately is the only antidote we have. Cory Doctorow's new book is actually four novellas. It's called Radicalized. Doctorow is one of today's best online journalists. He's a co-editor of Boing Boing, and he'll be signing books at C2E2 this weekend at McCormick Place. It's my pleasure to welcome back Cory Doctorow to WGN Radio. Cory, good to see you.
It's lovely to be back. I love your new studio.
It's not. Yeah, it's,
what of you?
It feels like it might be something that you would describe in one of your novels. Yeah, right.
Yeah, maybe just before it falls over.
Just before it falls over. Radicalized. This is four novellas in one. Why did you decide to go this route?
You know, I didn't. These were my Trump derangement syndrome antidotes. I was working on the third Little Brother book, and these stories just kind of battered their way through my fingertips in the interstices between working on the novel. And my agent, my editor, my publisher were all really excited about them and wanted to bring them out and treat them like a novel, which is pretty unheard of for a short story collection. We sold the TV rights to the first of the stories even before the book came out. And
congratulations on that.
Yeah. In negotiation. And so they really seem to have hit a chord. It's, you know, we can talk about utopia or dystopia. I think that it's a mistake to assume that just because someone's written a story about things going wrong that they're pessimistic. I think that only an idiot assumes that things will never go wrong. That doesn't make you a pessimist. You know, assuming things will never go wrong is why they never put lifeboats on the Titanic. You know, I think that it's more accurate to say that optimism is the idea that when things go wrong, that we can set them to rights again. Yeah. And they're really stories about people taking agency, taking control of the technology in their world, you know, seizing the means of information.
There's two parts to just take the story Unauthorized Bread for the first one. There's two parts. There is that feeling of technology gone amok, smart devices in our homes being classist in a way, being proprietary, making our lives much more difficult when they were designed to be better. Mm-hmm. But the other side is humanity and how we overcome that. And you find out in this story that even though there are a lot of things against the main character and against the characters in your book, you know, they do continually solve the problems through human ways.
Yeah, you know, there's this adoption curve for bad technology where when we have a terrible technological idea, we need someone to try it out on who, if they complain, no one will listen. So usually if we have a bad technological idea, first we try it out on refugees and then regular immigrants like me, and then we use it on prisoners and then parolees and then mental patients, kids, blue-collar workers, gig economy workers, and then eventually white-collar workers. So if you want to know what your kid's technological future looks like, look at what we're doing to prisoners. If you want to know what your technological future looks like, look at what we're doing to kids. And if you want to know what the prisoner's technological future is going to look like, look at how we're treating refugees with technology at any moment. So the protagonists of the story, the refugees, and they've come up against one of our worst technological ideas that's currently in play now, which is designing technology that treats its owner as its enemy and tries to control the owner so that they arrange their lives to benefit shareholders instead of themselves.
It's amazing. And it's not fictional. I mean, I know the book is fictional, but just to give listeners an idea, a toaster that would only toast the bread of the company.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, this is an idea that goes way back to printers and inkjet cartridges. But, you know, when the iPhone came out and they announced that, well, this is only going to run software that comes from the Apple Store, not because it can't run other software, it just will refuse to run other software. For some reason, a lot of people gave them a walk on that. But, you know, that idea, it's metastasized. Johnson & Johnson has regulatory approval for an implanted artificial pancreas with a glucose monitor and an insulin pump. And, you know, insulin's in the public domain. When the discoverers of insulin, Banting and Best, found it, they said, well, we're not going to patent this. It's too important.
Yeah, it's medicine.
But the cartridge is proprietary. And if you refill it, unless you have a code from Johnson & Johnson, it won't recognize the new insulin. And so they can turn human beings with diabetes into kind of walking inkjet printers who have to pay these gigantic premiums just to keep their internal organs working.
And, you know, for every story we see that flirts its way or peeks its head into the mainstream media, I think of the I think it was the insulin pen, whatever the deal,
EpiPen.
The EpiPen, where it was so expensive it made us all outraged that it was this expensive. There are thousands of stories like that don't reach our devices. We don't hear about it.
Well, and, you know, the interesting thing here is that you have these old laws that have been expanded beyond all reason to cover this stuff. You know, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 1201, makes it a felony to bypass a copyright lock. And so every manufacturer from John Deere to Johnson & Johnson to GM has put copyright locks in their devices that you have to bypass if you want to use them to benefit you. It's as though, you know, your car manufacturer had figured out a way to make it a felony to plug a phone charger into your cigarette lighter unless you bought it from them.
That is a big part of the stories that you're telling, especially with Unauthorized Bread. And it is amazing to me because just talking to Pete today and trying to explain to him, you know, what this story was about, and to hear you talking about real life stories you've fictionalized in the book that are real life and happening as we speak, it makes it creates pause.
Well, you know, I think these technological and policy stories, they can be very dry, very abstract. But when you turn them into fiction, they can put a lot of narrative meat on the dry, abstract policy bones. And can make people think about it, you know, like, if it were 1949 and we were arguing about whether we should use the peace dividend to put cameras everywhere, it would be kind of, I might say, well, my privacy would feel a bit weird about that. But, you know, once 1984 comes out, we can just say, well, that's a rather Orwellian idea, don't you think? Right. And that's one of the things I'm trying to get at here. You know, I have another life where I do policy advocacy, but writing about this stuff in fiction and giving a kind of architectural fly-through of what it would be like to live in a world if these policies aren't headed off, that I think is another powerful way to kind of intervene in the in both the policy space and also the artistic space.
And it is interesting, especially how you start the story with the way that in this present time, which is fictionalized, but in this present time, we're refugee camps in Arizona and refugee old shopping malls that have turned into refugee spaces and waiting lists to get into poor housing, all leading into really the base of the story about how technology is taking advantage of it.
Yeah, and you know, this moment of bad technology is happening at the same time a bunch of other bad policies. You know, we're living in a moment where it's the concentration of wealth at the very top has become very extreme, as many people have observed. And when that happens, it becomes harder and harder to create policy if it gores some rich person's ox. You know, when the influence of rich people gets bigger, it's hard to do things that cut against their interests. And the richer the rich people get, the more oxes they own. And so the fewer policies we can act. And one good example of this is housing. And, you know, every major city in the world is going through a housing crisis as speculators buy and flip houses. And we're in this really weird moment where this thing that's an absolute human essential, you know, with no shelter, you have no life, has become an asset. And so governments are trying to increase the value of housing. Well, imagine if states decided to increase the value of other fundamentals, right? Imagine if bread became twice as expensive during a politician's tenure. We never vote for them again. But when you have a world where we're all precarious, where the only major asset we own, the thing that we're hedging against for our retirement is our home, where we're so leveraged in that house that if it doesn't continue to go up in value, we might end up underwater. You know, every politician is perversely incentivized to make our houses as expensive as possible.
And I would say that it also innately we will look the other way as citizens, even, because at the end it's going to benefit us.
That's right. Yeah, we're all co-opted into this system, because, you know, while we all acknowledge that we'd like our kids to be able to buy houses, that homelessness is a real problem and so on, we're also running up against the limits of our own precarity, where we're worried that if those policies were enacted, it might end up turning us into paupers. And so we're kind of sandwiched between it. And, it, you know, one of the themes running through this book is the limits of individual action. We've had 40 years of this story about individual responsibility and individual consequences, and it only gets you so far. You know, I don't care how careful you are about your recycling, it's not going to fix climate change.
Cory Doctorow, my guest. The book is Radicalized. He's in Chicago. He's at C2E2, the big Comic-Con at the McCormick Place this weekend. He'll be talking and signing books at both on Saturday and Sunday. Cory Doctorow, my guest in the 8 o'clock hour tonight here on Extension 720. We'll take a break. Come back. Stay with us. Oh, that's great. Cory Doctorow in studio, Extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. Cory Doctorow's new book, Radicalized, which is a look at the future, but it's really a look at the present. It's four tales of our present moment. He's going to be at C2E2 this weekend, and he's in studio tonight. As we talk about technology and our future, last time you were here, it was for, I think it's for Runaway.
Walkaway,
I'm sorry. Walkaway, and we talked about, which is funny because that's our whole premise tonight, walking away. But it was a lot about copyright and And also just about, are we, like the idea of surviving versus, I don't even know what the survivalist versus technology, and I'm sorry I'm not describing it quite right, but it's just interesting that you continue on this thread. You continue to push these stories and these storylines. When you talk about being a futurist writer, what are you looking to write about?
You know, I never want to write about the future. I only ever want to write parables about the present. I really feel like if they are ever going to chisel something on my tombstone, which they're not because I'm going to leave my remains for med school pranks, but if they ever want to chisel something on my tombstone, I want it to be, this could all be so great if we don't screw it up. Because, you know, I grew up with computers. I was an 80s kid. My dad was a computer scientist. And I know that the promise of them, right? I know that this impetus to connect with other people is a noble one, to find people who have the same interests as you and you know, collaborate with them and have exciting new friendships and connections and communities. But I also know all the ways that computers can be hijacked to surveil us, to control us, to subvert our social relationships, to commodify them. And I don't think that opting out is an option. We live in a very technological society, and there's no going back. You know, if the technology fails, the mountain of bodies left behind will be sufficient to create so many pathogens that it will kill everyone that it doesn't kill.
That's right, that's right.
You know, I think that we have to figure out how to get it right. You know, Stuart Brand, the guy who started the Whole Earth Review and the Whole Earth Catalog and The Well and so many other things, Wired Magazine, he said, if we're going to be like gods, we might as well get good at it. And, you know, I think we are very bad gods at this moment, and figuring out how to use technology wisely, and part of that is writing fiction that is both about the promise and the peril of technology. That's a really important mission that we're on right now.
We talked about Unauthorized Bread, and there's three other stories, we'll get to them, but the you know, one of the issues in that story has to do with the concept that the way around the way technology is subverting us or keeping us down or controlling us is humanity, is this idea, the jailbreak, the way that humans are going to find a way to persevere and get around technology. How does that play out in real life?
Well, you know, I think that we're long past the moment at which people would try to find a path from A to Z. You know, where it's like, well, I know where I want to get to, and I know exactly how I'm going to get there in terms of my theory of change. And we now acknowledge that we're in this complex terrain that we could never traverse easily, that we could never plot a course across. And instead, what we try to do is have like a rule of thumb, like, how do I know if I'm going in the right direction? And for me, that's the difference between a kind of fatalistic optimism, where things will just get better and I don't need to participate in them, and hope. Hope is the idea that if you strive hard enough, and if there are people around you striving with you, that you may be able to make a difference. And so you have people, for example, who write code, and that code opens up new technological possibilities. You have people who do things in the market. They start businesses or support businesses, and those open up new possibilities and create new stakeholders. You have people who advocate for laws. And you have people who have normative conversations, like this one we're having, mm-hmm. who advocate for better ways of thinking about things. You know, there was a time when, in the early days of STEM education, where it was a form of self-defense, right? There was activists who started STEM education. They said, you have to program or be programmed. If you don't teach people how to be masters of their technologies will be masters of them. And that's been co-opted into this idea that if you don't get your kids a STEM education, they won't get a good job. Well, you know, a STEM education can help you get a good job, but what a STEM education can really do is help you seize the means of information and ensure that the technology that was designed to force you to arrange your affairs to benefit the firm mm-hmm. that made it can be rearranged so that it benefits you first.
To understand the life you're living.
Yeah, yeah, and to understand that the things that seem like vast, impersonal forces are in fact choices that someone made. You know, people talk about Google and privacy and surveillance capitalism. No one came down off a mountain with 2 stone tablets that said, thou shalt stop rotating thine log files and instead mine them for actionable market intelligence. Someone made a choice, right? To store that data, to mine it, and ultimately, as we keep seeing, to leak it and leak it and leak it and destroy life after life after life. And all those people who say, well, it's unfortunate that we leaked the data, but who could have foreseen it? Those people need to be held to account someday, because honestly, anyone could have foreseen it.
Cory Doctorow is my guest. He's at C2E2 tomorrow, signing books and speaking to the crowd. Radicalized is a new book. We'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's headlines, and we'll continue our conversation with Cory Doctorow here on Extension 720. Stay with us.
Back to Justin Kaufman and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight, Cory Doctorow, the great author, his new book, Radicalized. You were here before with Walk Away. You're going to be at C2E2 this weekend. You're the co-editor at Boing Boing. Mm-hmm. You are our tech savior in the way that you're starting conversations. And I guess as we pick up where we left off, you talk about a need for us to have these conversations, mm-hmm. that more often than not, there any sort of stories that have to do with our digital world or technology or corporatizing of that technology, mm-hmm. just gets glossed over, or it's too hard for people to understand, so they just don't want to be involved in it. But you have been at Boing Boing and with your fiction work, but also just as a policy, I don't want to call you a wonk, but policy guy.
Activist.
You've dedicated your life to trying to have this conversation. Are people listening?
Yeah, you know, here's what I think has happened. I think that we've had really bad tech policy, not because tech is too complicated to understand. I mean, like, epidemiology and microbiology are hard to understand, but we're not all dead of listeria, even though we don't have a lot of biologists in Congress, right?
Right.
The way that we ended up not dead of listeria is we had a process by which you had experts and you had expert agencies, and the regulators regulated the firms, and they kind of tried to find evidence and measure outcomes and so on. And and any other kind of technology is not so different. What's changed is that it's become very hard to have evidence-based policy. And it's been hard to get people to care about it, mm-hmm. because the policy debt doesn't come due for a long time, right? We've had an inkling about climate change for a long time, 25, 30 years. But because the cause and the effect are separated by so much time and space, it's very hard to definitively convince people, especially people who don't want to be convinced, especially people who are in a world where someone's spending a lot of money to keep them from being convinced that there's something going on here that they need to pay attention to. And so you end up with this thing where the job of an activist for the first 20 years is convincing people that there's a problem. But then you reach what I call the point of peak indifference, where the problem, because it's real, eventually just reaches a breaking point where people's lives are being ruined on the regular by the problem. And you see this with climate, you see this privacy and data breaches, you see this with all kinds of policies that we've not had evidence-based policy on. And then people start to realize that there's a problem, but then they start to think, well, maybe it's too late to do anything about it. Yeah. And so the job switches from convincing people that there's a problem to convincing people that something can be done. You know, if I spend 20 years trying to convince you that you need to care about rhino populations, and then by the time you care, there's only one rhino left, it's really tempting to say, you know, might as well find out what he tastes like, right? And so we really need to kind of head off that nihilism. And that's a thing that fiction is really good at. It's really good at telling stories that show you what the shape of resistance looks like. It may not be like a specific roadmap. We're never going to be, you know, Dumbledore's army. We're never going to be the resistance. We're never going to be the rebellion. But it shows you the shape of what that looks like, what that solidarity looks like, what that pushing back looks like.
Are you getting people's attention more through your work of fiction than you are through your policy activism?
I think that they're really complementary. You know, I've been fighting about this European copyright
director,
which is this long story we could talk all night about, but it's, you know, TLDR, it's this idea in Europe that's being voted on late Monday night, Tuesday morning their time, that if it passes would be the end of the internet as we understand it and would give us an age in which the internet was just cable TV forever. And you know, there's been a lot of policy fights about it.
So we're talking censorship or
it's basically everyone's got to have copyright filters. So everything you say and do on the internet is going to have to be sucked into a copyright filter, check to see whether the filter thinks that it's a copyright infringement, and block it if it thinks that it is. And copyright infringement in this case means, does it match a thing in a database that anyone can add anything to? I could put the whole works of Shakespeare in there. No one could quote Shakespeare until someone went in and took it out.
Oh my gosh, it's your book. It's exactly what you're writing
about.
Yeah,
idea.
Right, right.
But, you know, I wrote a short story about this being used against people who discover a Chinese trawler violating a fishery agreement and fishing with long nets. And they have drones, and they do a super high-tech operation. They get the footage, they get the evidence, they use sonar and radar to capture the net and so on, and they upload it to the internet, and they're trending, and then all of a sudden it all disappears because the fishing company has uploaded their videos to the copyright filters and made it disappear. And that got much more of a spread than all these dry policy fights. Mm. But what that did was it directed people to the dry policy stuff so that they could take place. And now, on tomorrow, we're planning for the largest European street demonstrations in recent memory. We've got 5 million signatures on a petition, more signatures than any petition in world history, right? So we're like, we may win, you know?
It's a sad story, and it's one that I think there's a lot of, we go into the political aspects of this and what we expect from our government and what we expect from the free market. And that's mm-hmm. an argument that's been had between the right and left in the world over time. But it also just feels that people are figuring out, mostly in the corporate level, how to weaponize tech and to use it for their gain. And as you mentioned at the beginning, you know, this idea that it's to keep people enslaved or to keep people in line or in control. And that almost is antithetical to how the internet was even built.
Well, and it's funny because that's the thing that actually markets are pretty good at, right? Like if I sold you a fridge where the butter dish was an add-on and it came with a special bolt with a screw that you had to unscrew and, you know, you had to give me $10 for the screwdriver to unscrew it, someone would sell you the screwdriver for 99 cents. The thing is that as markets have concentrated and firms have gotten bigger, so we've got five big internet firms, five big movie studios that became four this week, four big record labels, five big publishers that are about to become four because it looks like Simon & Schuster is going to end up part of HarperCollins. As these industries have concentrated, they've been able to call the shots more and more. And so now, you know, in a technological sense, when John Deere puts a lock on its tractors that stops farmers from accessing their own field data about their soil conditions that's generated by driving their own tractors around their own fields, that has the force of law behind it. You know, thanks to a Clinton-era law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it's a potential felony punishable by a five-year prison sentence to provide a farmer with a tool that lets them break open their tractor and access that data.
It makes me think about you're right, the market seems to be correcting itself in the way that they will say, oh,
could correct itself. Yeah, sure.
But I think a lot of people are ineffectual or may not be interested in this or like you said, haven't really found their breaking point yet because they expect the government to protect them.
Which, you know, it's not a crazy idea to think that, like, well, you know, when I fill up my glass from the tap, I don't bring along my assay kit to figure out how much lead there is in the water, right? We live in a complex technological society, and we can't all be experts on all of the subjects that need to be handled correctly in order for us to navigate the world. And so you need to believe that your 737 Boeing MAX was safe and not designed as it seems with the safety features as an extra that you have to pay as an upgrade as an airline. That is a real story. You know, we don't know exactly what caused those planes to fail, but we do know that Boeing had a thing that helped pilots resolve conflicts between two key sensors, and that wasn't sold standard. It was an add-on. And that we know that the airlines in poorer countries didn't buy the add-on.
But regardless, and no one is saying that that's what caused those airlines to crash. But what it tells you is that this idea of what we're talking about technology and how it becomes corporatized, that they're finding ways when it comes to even airplane safety to say, well, here's a way we can make money off of that.
Well, and you know, again, like you would expect that in a fair society, on the one hand, you'd have regulators who'd smack them around when they did this kind of stuff. And on the other hand, you'd expect that you'd have companies that would enter the market to correct it. But, you know, they call anything that the big five tech companies are doing, the venture capitalists call it the kill zone. So you can't get funded to start a search engine today or a social media network or a competitor to Apple. You know, those markets are unassailable because they've got them sewn up. You know, when you hear people like Elizabeth Warren talking about breaking up big tech, what they're really talking about is reestablishing markets.
You know, let's talk about politics real quick. We saw a lot with the Green New Deal. Uh-huh. And this was something that came out not too long ago. And really, you heard from the sponsors of the build or the idea or the letter, the summary, whatever you want to call it, that this was a this was a starting off point. This is the conversation, like you mentioned.
Right.
We need to have more of these conversations. But the conversation quickly became partisan. And it's something that became hype around the personalities, the cult of personality, whoever wrote it, Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah.
But it if you really look at the form and what they were doing, they were talking about a new Bill of Rights. You mentioned housing earlier. In the Green New Deal, they talk about affordable housing as a right. That we need to set the new rules in which we live and abide by as human beings on this planet.
Yeah.
That is a noble thing for our politicians to be talking, is it not?
Yeah. And, you know, I think that we can talk about this in all kinds of ways. So we can talk about the fact that, like, it's a good deal to have people in your city not living on the streets, right? It's a good deal because it's cheaper than the cost of homelessness in terms of policing and emergency services and the spread of tuberculosis. And speaking as someone who used to live in the Mission District of San Francisco, human feces on your sidewalk, no fun, and all of those other things, plus the grinding, soul-numbing misery of stepping over unconscious people on your way home and on your way back. And it's all of those things make it a good deal. But let's set all that aside and just say that if your empathy is so hobbled that you don't understand that the people who live in the same city as you deserve to have a roof over their heads, especially people who are working hard, but even people who are struggling, then we have a problem because we have, again, a shared destiny. And most of us are in precarious circumstances. And in fact, ironically, I think it's that precariousness that makes us say, well, how can I afford to give to you when I'm not sure where I'm going to end up? But the answer is,
right.
If you're not sure where you're going to end up, then you should be really concerned about the net. And right now, we're living without a net.
It's an interesting thought. And it's not just housing, because you look at climate change, you can say we have the right to clean air.
Sure.
We have the right to clean water. These are not rights that are in the Bill of Rights that our forefathers decided
Although
to put
life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is hard when you're dying of lead poisoning.
That's true. But it seems to me that these are the conversations we should be having. Instead, we almost look to WGN, to CNN, to Fox News, to whatever, to dictate the conversation. If you look at all the stuff right now, it's about a Mueller report.
Right
now, they're talking right now about what could possibly be in it. We know what's in it.
Right. Well, maybe we know. I mean, I think our political consensus is really far away from the actual consensus of the people. You know, if you think about something like, say, net neutrality, it's kind of a no-brainer, right? It's the idea that, like, if you have an internet connection, the people who sell it to you should get you the internet resources that you ask for, and not the ones that make them the most money, right? 87% of Americans support that policy, which is pretty crazy when you think that, like, this is the intersection of competition policy and telecoms. Like, that is not so much a Venn diagram as it is a sphincter, and yet 87% right. of Americans
87%.
Are, like, hardcore for net neutrality. Same with universal health care. Same with, you know, sensible controls on guns, and so on and so on. The Washington consensus and the, you know, kind of establishment media consensus is really far away from the actual political consensus in the country. And, you know, we talk about the country being polarized. It's not really polarized. You have a giant middle that wants something that a tiny minority of people don't. That's not polarization. That's just like anti-majoritarianism in action, right? Where it's the tyranny of the minority.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe we'll show up in... it's funny to think about the themes and the things that we're talking about are things that are in both of all the books that you've put together,
yeah.
including Radicalized.
Well, you know, this the last story in this book, The Mask of the Red Death, is about the limits of individual action in crisis. It's about a rich prepper in Arizona. He's got this bunker. He's ready for the end times. He's going to go and hide out with his friends who are all crack shots, and he's got, you know, thumb drives full of Bitcoin and gemstone quality stones and lots of bullion and all the MREs you can eat, and he's just going to hunker down while the lesser people eliminate each other, and then he'll emerge into and, you know, kind of reenact a Frazetta painting and become, like, you know, a warlord with a harem or something. And what he fails to recognize is that the real heroes of a disaster are not the ones who run away, they're the ones who run too, right? They're the ones who get the sanitation running again.
Yeah.
The people who run away are the ones who die of cholera.
You know, we'll wrap up here, but in South by, you were just at South by Southwest, and yeah. You did a panel, and it was interesting because it was about the perception of AI mm-hmm. from a Hollywood standpoint versus mm-hmm. reality. Those mm-hmm. storylines from movies like Terminator,
yeah, sure.
or you know, HAL, or I'm thinking of others like even The Matrix to a certain
yeah,
extent.
Sure.
But this concept that Hollywood has hijacked AI and what artificial intelligence really means. And, you know, what did you learn from that panel?
The thing that always strikes me when we talk about machine learning is that if we call machine learning by the name that we called it until a few years ago, which is statistics, instead of data science and artificial intelligence, it would be a lot easier to unpick. You know, look at Chicago and other cities that have bought predictive policing services from so-called machine learning or AI companies. What they're doing is they're saying, well, our police are racist. They operated an off-the-books black site full of torture. They engaged in stop and frisk. We need to have an algorithm objectively tell them where the crime is going to be. So we're going to ask it to analyze where the crime was and then from that predict where the crime is going to be. Except you're not asking it to predict where the crime, look at where the crime was. You're asking it to look at where the arrests were. And your starting premise is that the arrests were racially biased. And so, you know, it's like going into a classroom full of third graders and measuring them all and then doing a statistical analysis and then making a prediction about how tall some arbitrary stranger is. You're like, I bet that stranger is 4'2", right? You know, In the days when we called this stuff statistics, we had a motto, garbage in, garbage out. Right now that we call it machine learning, we're like, it is inscrutable, it can't be interrogated,
right.
We can't know what it means, we just have to do what the machine says. You know, there may be better methods for making the computer science work, but the way that we're doing now it is the worst method. You know, we have companies that are mining data in opaque ways that don't show what their data is, that don't tell you how they do it, that don't expose their results to public scrutiny, that bind the cities that sign contracts to them to non-disparagement and non-disclosure clauses so they can't tell you what's wrong, nor can they complain about it. You know, I don't know exactly how you make a good system, but I know how you make a bad one. That's how you make a bad system.
Cory Doctorow, always a pleasure, man. Always,
thank you very
always
much.
Great to have
absolutely
you here.
My pleasure,
the new book is Radicalized, which is out now, and you can see him at C2E2 tomorrow and Sunday, the great Comic Con, which is at the McCormick Place right here in Chicago. Cory, thanks again, man.
Thank you.
Can't wait. I cannot wait for Cory Doctorow to come back. Right? Last time we had him on, I think he was at the Printers Row Book Fair. And he came through with Walk Away. And I think it's hilarious, Pete, that the theme of tonight's show is Walk Away. His last book was called Walk Away. And I'm like, your last book was Runaway. Come on. Come on, Kaufman. 312-981-7200. We are still continuing the theme, walking away. And coming up, we continue our neighborhood tour. We're going to Chatham. Chatham is a great community on the south side of Chicago. We go to Mather's at 83rd and State to meet Kathy Cheney to talk about all the things that are facing that community, including crime.
Because Chatham has always been one of those close-knit, familial neighborhoods where everyone felt like a relative. You looked out for each other. It made you feel safe. So when you have so many people coming in and going out constantly, there's a sense of security that it's lost.
So here we go. We're going to Chatham today, tonight, coming up in the next hour. And also, Glenn Phillips from Toad the Wet Sprocket will be here. We'll do the interview and also another live song from Glenn Phillips. So that's all coming up on Extension 720. This is Extension 720 on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later, Glenn Phillips from Toad the Wet Sprocket, an interview and live performance. But first, Chicago's always been known as a city of neighborhoods. But this mayoral election, doesn't it feel like we've kind of forgotten that? Sure, the candidates are crisscrossing the city, shaking the trees for votes, but what do we need to know about the state of our city through the voices of our neighbors? We continue our tour of Chicago neighborhoods tonight. We've already been to Jefferson Park and Inglewood. Tonight, we stay on the south side with Chatham. Chatham has always been known as the home to the black middle class, 79th Street to 95th, all along the Dan Ryan Expressway. But times have changed, and the neighborhood has seen a share of that change. crime, violence, and the loss of small businesses that once was a hallmark of this proud hood. And then recently, residents were shocked when Target decided to close its Cottage Grove location. Politically, the ward is represented by a few different aldermen, namely Roderick Sawyer, who's the head of the Black Caucus in City Council, but he didn't get 50% of the vote, so he's in a runoff. Former police officer Richard Wooten. So what are the issues in Chatham? I turned to my old partner in crime, Kathy Cheney. Kathy and I work together at NPR, but she's currently editing the breaking news desk at the Chicago Sun-Times. She used to work at WVON and the Chicago Defender and is active in diversifying newsrooms. Kathy picked the place, Mathers, at 83rd and State. Mathers is half cafe, half senior center, a fitness center and wellness center for the over 50 crowd. And they make a mean cup of coffee. What kind of neighborhood is Chatham?
Chatham is, it's a very nice community. It's a small community. It's a community that's generational. We have longtime residents who have, like, passed down their homes to their kinfolk. But you do have some newcomers that are coming, too, because some of the population is dying off. And the residents are just really trying to preserve the history, the foundation, the institutional memory that it's always, you know, been here.
You grew up in the area. Did you grow up in Chatham? Auburn Gresham?
Closer to there, but yeah. I've been here for the last 25 years.
So you've seen in 25 years' time, you've seen a lot change in Chatham.
Yes.
How, is it for the better, for the worse?
I want to say that it is, I don't want to say for the worse, but I have noticed a definite change. I have noticed more youths in the neighborhood. I've noticed more renters, especially for homes, than homeowners. So there's been a lot of turnaround with that. And I know that there's been a lot of complaints with that throughout Chatham because, you know, you have that whole block club feeling where everyone knows everyone. Everyone looks out for each other. But when you have home renters that are constantly coming in,
turning over,
right? They may be here for 2 years. Sometimes you see them for like 6 months and you just go. There are a couple of houses on my block where I just don't even try to figure out what they look like because
there's some neighborhoods, I mean, think some Northside neighborhoods like Bucktown or Wrigleyville or Lakeview where that's the constant. They're renting all the time and they're able to turn it over and they don't seem to necessarily see that as a challenge or a problem. So what's different about it in Chatham?
Because Chatham has always been one of those close-knit, familial neighborhoods where everyone felt like a relative. You looked out for each other. It made you feel safe. So when you have so many people coming in and going out constantly, there's a sense of security that it's lost. So that you know, makes you a little uneasy.
You know, we hear in the news all the time about African-Americans in Chicago leaving. Like they're splitting, and not just in the city, but the state of Illinois. I would assume that has an impact on Chatham when you talk about renters coming in. It's because a lot of people are leaving. Do you see it that way? Is there a lot of people from Chatham and then surrounding neighborhoods that are pick it up and leaving, and why?
I haven't seen a huge shift yet. I know some people always say, you know, I'm tired of the city, I'm going to the suburbs, and then they get to the suburbs and they're like, okay, it's just like the city. They didn't escape anything. They're saying I could have just stayed where I was. So I'm seeing a little less of people wanting to go to the suburbs because they think it's safer. So just a little bit of a shift, but not that much.
Okay, so what are the big issues here? What are the issues in Chatham that A, are they being talked about in the mayor's race or not?
A big issue for me, because I am a resident, I have seen an increase in crime. So definitely need that addressed.
What kind of crime?
Shootings.
Really?
Just shootings. And because I'm like on the breaking news desk, I just see it,
you see it all
even
time?
More.
Yeah.
Where I'm looking at these addresses and I'm like, ooh, this is a little bit too close to home now. But I'm seeing an increase of that. And it all depends on, every neighborhood has that small group of blocks that's really, really nice and safe. And then you go one block over there and there's that cluster that's really bad. And that's within every neighborhood. But more so, you're kind of seeing it on blocks that you normally wouldn't. And it's just, it's kind of random. Then it's not random, but it's scary at the same time. And then when you have renters that are just coming in and then leaving after 6 months or a year, it gives you pause, you know.
Okay. You also have economic development issues. I mean, there was a lot made of the Target leaving.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Oh, my God. I cried.
I mean, that's a big issue. I think I would cry if the Target left my neighborhood. And
yes.
And I think that's at least an issue I think that a lot of people can relate to because, mm-hmm. just as we said, if you're listening right now and you're like, they're going to take the Target from my neighborhood. But yeah, that's a big issue. Is it going to play in the election?
I think that it will play just a little bit. I mean, so right now it's like, okay, what are you going to put right there at that Target? That's a huge space.
Where is it at?
87th and Cottage Grove.
Yeah.
So it's a huge space. You can look right over there off of 79th and the Dan Ryan, where there used to be a huge Jewels. Now there's Foreman Mills. Sorry, but I don't know who goes to shop there. But, you know, hey, it's still there. There used to be Blockbuster, if you remember your Blockbuster days. That was across the street. Now that big building is a daycare center. So you see the economic development, I really don't know.
It's weird because I've always known Chatham to be a stable when it came to economic development.
It
was an area that had big box stores and other places coming in because they recognized that people want to spend money. So what's the difference? Why is this quickly becoming a neighborhood or an area that a Target wouldn't want to be in?
I just think it has a lot to do with when we had the big box ordinance, Walmart came, which I was okay with, but it, you know, cut some stores down. And then we don't live in a food desert, but you've got all these other different stores. I think too many of the wrong kind of places are popping up. You've got two or three nail shops.
You
on
can
every
say
damn
it.
Block.
Strip club car washes. You can say it.
You can say it.
I mean, you've got two or three nail shops on one block. Then you go two blocks down and you've got two others. I'm okay with barbershops. You know, everybody gets to get their hair cut. Everyone needs their hair done. But if it's not the nail shops, then you'll see that it's a liquor store. I'm not adverse to liquor. But you just see too much of the same stuff. And then you see the regular, and they're not mom-and-pop stores anymore.
Right.
They're small stores, but they are bleeding the residents dry with the prices that they, you know, give you. So they're not your mom-and-pop store where you can go in and actually do some grocery shopping and from the people that you know that care about you, and they're not trying to gouge you. They're just complete outsiders coming in knowing that you don't really have an option. You don't want to get in your car. Or you may not want to get on the bus to go, you know, 1 mile to the grocery store.
Right.
So
Chatham has always been a middle-class neighborhood, mm-hmm. African-American neighborhood in Chicago. So much is made of who the South Side's going to vote for. Willie Wilson stepping up and saying whoever he endorses, everyone's going to follow. And
you remember
and,
our band?
Yeah. So do you see it that way? I mean, it almost acts like in the city that it's one big monolith that, you know, the South Side is one big neighborhood and they're all going to go in one direction.
This time, I don't think that's going to be the case. I think that there's going to be a portion of Dr. Wilson. I think a portion will go to Tony Preckwinkle. I think a portion will go to Lori Lightfoot. I think there's a group of undecided voters that voted for him that are still trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
But he, surprisingly, I mean, he had a great chunk of the black vote. So
huge chunk.
Yes. I mean,
were you surprised by that?
No, I learned my lesson from the first time, and, you know, I lost the bet, and I was in my cheer gear, so do you remember that? No, I learned my lesson, so no. I didn't bet against Willie. I was just saying, you know, the percentage that he was probably going to get. I didn't think he was going to get in double digits the last time.
He improved on it.
Yes, he did. So this time around, I was just like, hey, I'm not predicting.
I just wonder. It'll be interesting because I always think about it in the media, and I think about you because when we worked together, you were able to synthesize headlines down that maybe I wasn't that aware of or the staff wasn't aware of what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see an endorsement or who the South Side or the West Side's going to vote for, and you think about that as almost one voting block or one, mm-hmm. you know, genre, it's just not the case. When you have Chatham and you have Armour Gresham, and you have mm-hmm. Inglewood, and you have South Shore, and you have High Bar. They all are different neighborhoods
exactly.
with different voting blocks.
Exactly. They all have their different challenges. Some of them have the same, but there are a lot of different challenges. Some of the needs that Chatham needs may not be all that Inglewood needs, you know. So it's like the mayoral candidates really need to go into each neighborhood to find out what's really at the heart of what the residents want.
Are they coming here? Are the two candidates coming to Chatham? Have you seen them on the street?
I haven't seen them on the street, but I'm at work in the newsroom all the time. I think that's a good thing for them to sit back and listen to a large swath of residents on both sides, but I really need them to get back to the basics of, you know, what each community needs. So I really need them to get back to the issues and all the negative politics, you know, just... Okay, I know you need to put out your ads and all this type of stuff, but I really don't care. I don't care what commercial you put out. I'm not listening to it anyway. I just want to hear what you are going to do for me and the rest of Chicago. That's all I really care about.
Kathy, do you think that, where are we in Chicago to, in 2019? You lived in Chatham for 25 years. You lived in Chicago your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
Are we better off today in 2019 than, say, 2000, 2010? Ooh. You know, what do you think? What do you think of where we live?
You know what? Being a journalist and seeing everything, and I guess having my ears and eyes open to a lot more than the average resident has, I want to say that we had it a little bit better back then, because I didn't know a lot of stuff was going on. And it's not one of those I want to be, you know, blind to everything, right, and right, just ignore it. But I just think I lived a little bit more in peace, you know, without knowing everything.
Well,
so now that
I mean,
I know
it's a different time for you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, your family's older now.
Mm-hmm.
And the issues that you have now as a parent,
yeah,
of teenagers,
my God,
much different than maybe, you know,
completely,
when they were kids or
like
toddlers.
It completely, like, changes the way that I govern accordingly. So it's like everything that I used to do, be able to go out, have fun or whatever, this, my kids, I'm like, if I can't see you on the street, then that's a problem. It's like, do not go out of my eyesight, you know. And I'm still that way now, even though they're pretty much grown, but it's just the whole safety factor. It's kind of nerve-wracking at the same time, and social media just doesn't make it any better. Man.
I never talk about the impact social media has on moms, huh?
On me, yes. Definitely on parents. And then just the way that we consume news, we find out everything
as
each,
yeah,
second,
yeah,
goes by. And it's just like, oh my goodness, it just really, really consumes you, and it makes you more on edge.
Are you going to stay in Chatham the rest of your life?
I don't plan to. But my husband, he grew up in Chatham, so he's like a lifelong Chatham resident. So, you know, I'm taking one for the team. Now, when I retire, it's either Atlanta or L.A. Now, when I retire, I have no idea. I'll probably die in
the newsroom. Why those towns? I mean, is that just for the weather, or what is it about Atlanta?
My maternal side, they're from Georgia, all throughout Georgia. And every time I go to Atlanta, I just feel like I'm at home. I feel like I'm in Chicago, so it just feels natural to me. And L.A. is actually the same way. I do have some family there, but it just feels right. It just feels right. I just feel at home, and I like to be somewhere if I'm on vacation and I feel at home, you know, where it's just like, oh, I got to leave tomorrow, you know, just, no, I feel at home. New York is nice, but I don't feel home there. 3 days and that's it.
Kathy Cheney on the South Side in Chatham. Next week, got a lot of great stuff coming up. We're going to head to Beverly. We're going to head to Andersonville, Logan Square, South Shore, Belmont Cragen, and Hyde Park. I think coming up on Tuesday, we're going to do Hyde Park with Mario.
There's been a big amount of black flight. Black people are bouncing out of here left and right. How are you keeping people in Chicago? How are you going to make the South and West Sides better? How do you take that downtown money and spread it around the city? You know, there's so many how do you do. I guess we'll find out April 2nd. I don't know.
That's coming up next week, as well as many more of our Chicago neighborhood tours, trying to get them in before the runoff election, which is on April 2nd. You can find all those stories at WGNradio.com on our Extension 720 page. Coming up, Glenn Phillips from Toad the Wet Sprocket. Stay with us. Coming up, Glenn Phillips, Toad the Wet Sprocket. He's at Old Town School of Folk Music. A conversation with him coming up about 30 years of Toad the Wet Sprocket and his new album, which is very personal, about his divorce, his marriage that lasts 23 years. He poured his heart and soul into his new solo record, Shallowed by the New, and he will play something off that record, and we'll talk about his very intense personal exploration coming up here after the 9:30 news. Coming up next week, I mentioned that we're going to be doing Hyde Park. We've got some stuff about South Shore. We're also going to be talking in Beverly. There's a lot of great stuff coming up, and Pete and I have been all over the city in the last 3 days.
You guys have.
It's crazy. This will give you an idea. We had the day off yesterday before we did, you know, we were preempted last night. We started the morning at Belmont and Central.
Okay.
Okay, so that was probably 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning. Then we had to go down to South Shore, to 71st Street and Jeffrey.
Okay. Did you go to the South Shore Cultural Club?
No. We went to Will Calloway's campaign office. We're doing a Walk the Ward piece. It'll be on next week with some of the candidates during the runoff. So we went to Alderman Hairston's office as well. That was 71st and South Shore.
Yeah.
And then because we were doing the same for the 30th Ward, so we had Jessica Gutierrez in the morning. Then we had to go back to Diversey and Central to talk with Alderman Raboyrus. And so just in that alone, plus all the other stuff in between, we saw a lot of Chicago. We saw just to think about going from the northwest side to the southeast side.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty crazy. And today we're in Beverly, which is...
Love Beverly. That's my old stomping grounds.
We were right by that. We were at 99th and Walden. We were right at the train station there.
Oh, my! I know exactly where that is, where there's the Starbucks and the new Pizza Depot.
We were at B-Side's Coffee Shop, which is a new coffee shop there.
I know where that is. I grew up at 91st and Pulaski.
Oh, great.
So around that area.
Awesome. Well, then,
Borderline Oaklawn.
Yes, that's where Pete Zimmerman is from. He's
Pete, my guy.
That's right.
Southside represents.
There you go. So yeah, Beverly coming up next week too, as well as Andersonville and Logan Square. So we are all over the place as we bring you Chicago neighborhood conversations. All right, coming up, Glenn Phillips. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my next guest is in town at the Old Town School of Folk Music tonight. I first met Glenn Phillips at a meet and greet at the Woodfield Mall. It was 1992, and his band was playing that night at Harper College. That band had just released a new album called Fear. It was being played on college rock, mostly at first, but at WXRT started playing the single All I Want and the follow-up Walk on the Ocean. Am I getting warmer? The band I saw was called Toad the Wet Sprocket, and they went on to be a household name in modern rock. They sold over 4 million records. They're also touring this summer to celebrate 30 years of Toad, but Glenn Phillips isn't here with the band. He's here touring on his solo record. It's called Swallowed by the New. The album came out last summer, got great reviews, as Phillips put his personal life into the album, reflecting on a recent divorce from his wife of 23 years. Glenn Phillips, wonderful to see you again.
Great to see you. Hello.
That show is fun to think of back to 1992, but it was a show that was in a community college and right outside of Chicago. And you know, it was interesting because probably a blip on all the shows that you've done in your life. But for the people I were with and the 8 people that came out to the show, it was seminal. It was like a moment. Do you think about that? Like the idea that so many people have moments around your music, around your band.
I've had a lot of moments around music. I mean, it saved my life more than once. It's odd at a personal level to be part of that same thing for other people, but it's also the function of music.
Yeah.
It's to, you know, I don't know.
Is there a point where you recognize that? Is it more and more people recognized who you were and your music and used your music and had it be part of their emotional experience? Is there a point in your career where you're like, oh man, I had no idea so many people knew Toad the Wet Sprocket?
Yeah, I mean, more a change in thinking about music for its functionality, I guess, as a technology for kind of, in you know, spiritual or emotional change or growth, and rather than I'm in a band, it's fun, I got these songs, let's play.
Right.
You know, it's like there's that whole side of it, and the part that's easier to market, and especially the part that is That I think the center of rock and roll that started as this voice of youth and voice of rebellion, and this, you know, with this idea that every, you know, it's the music of the young and beautiful and somewhat disenfranchised,
yeah,
but with enough resources to buy a ticket, right? And so it's been interesting to grow and age and watch rock age with us, right? And we're mm-hmm. a few generations into this movement now. And the 90s was even in this particular, you know, period of having this punk rock attitude of bands going into working with the major labels and having hits on the radio, but trying to be cool and anti-commercial and hate their label and hate their single. And hate, you know, we were this like really awful era of, you know, these really awkward hypocrisies. But as I get older, and I've been doing in the last couple of years, a lot of, community choir leading, you know, just like living room choirs, 12 to 30 people, and, you know, songs that you can kind of orally teach quickly, and getting people who have been told they can't sing to open up their mouth again and join in. And to get, I mean, there's like, you get a bit of a contact high in the audience, yeah. but the people who are getting the highest at the concert are the musicians, right?
Yeah.
Not in a substance way, but like, to be making that sound is a transcendent experience.
It sounds to me that even with Toad the Wet Sprocket, I mean, mm-hmm. and the work that you're doing now, and I want to get into the new record, but there seems to be a need to find purpose, or at least to be a satisfying experience for music. Like, it's not just about making music, being ambitious and being the best rock and roll band in the world, but there seems to be that it courses through your blood, and it manifests itself in so many different ways. But really, truly, at the end of the day, it's about finding purpose or satisfaction.
Yeah, and I guess that was a very long-winded and inconclusive way of saying, I think I started this just kind of more guided by what lit me up, what made me feel good. And then the function of music for most of history, I mean, there are a few composers who were, you know, it was a methodical job and you were, you know, doing your commission work, but it's always been a sacred thing. It's always been a way that people wake up and a way that people connect, and not just a way that a small group of particularly accomplished musicians do it. Mm-hmm. It's something that's a birthright. It's something that if you're in any indigenous culture, it's like while you're pounding out your cornmeal or while you're working in the field or building a house or hunting, you sing, unless you're trying to be really quiet so you don't scare the deer away. But that you sing all the time together. That's just what people do. Yeah. And we don't do that. We watch other people sing and we professionalize it. And I think it's taking one of the most vital shared experiences we have, and like in the same way we take many other kind of sacred medicines and commodify them, I think we did the same with music. So it was weird to start out of just, I needed to express myself. I didn't care if it was music or theater or writing. Right. I was in high school when the band started, and then we got signed, and then it became career, and it took a long time for me to start reclaiming music for something that had nothing to do with commerce.
Well, and you talk about expression. This album, Swallowed by the New, it is about, and you can hear it in the vocals, you can hear it in the music. It's somewhat of a somber tale. I mean, it's about rebirth, but it's also about a divorce and a marriage that lasted 23 years. Mm-hmm. Is that what this is? Is it cathartic in a way that you're using this to express how you feel in this moment in your life?
Yeah. In some ways, I've talked to a few friends, like, it depends on how you write, but sometimes you're writing letters from your future better self to your current self. and so on this record, anybody who's been through divorce, it's a really painful thing, and it's very easy to get caught in blame, recrimination, especially if you're not the person who chose it, right?
Right.
The person who knows you best no longer wants to be your partner. That you can take that in a really harsh way. And it's always surprised me when somebody said, it was out of the blue. I have no idea. It's like, I know all the reasons. I would have given it another round, but I wasn't unaware of any of
our
issues.
You know, when you think about I think about this all the time because, you know, people will go to therapists for a lot of their issues, especially if mm-hmm. they're not artistic.
I did that too.
But I think that for musicians and for artists, and there's a long history of this, and people being able to express themselves and what they're going through, mm-hmm. even if it's painful, most of the times when it's painful, and it turns into something that resonates and relates to the listener.
Yeah. And I wanted to, rather than talk about the relationship, rather than talk about the individual things that get wrong, you know, that made it. And once again, it was categorically a successful relationship. We both still respect and love each other. Our kids are amazing. We won, you know, and we found our end. And, you know, it's been, you know, it's a major life change that I didn't plan on. But at the same time, this is strangely also been the most alive I felt in my entire adult life. I've been in more pain and had more change, but I got woken up in a way that's really important. And the album, I wanted to do something that was not just my story, right? And it's and to get out of this relational or transactional, you know, way of talking about it, it had to be more about grief, about the things that we love changing, about watching our lives take an unexpected turn and having to adapt to it, and about the capacity to love while you're hurt by those who love you. And so, I mean, what's made me really proud of this record is that it's spoken to people who are going through illness, who've just lost family members, that it applies as well. And I found that the literature I was reading during my divorce, it was not divorce literature. It wasn't about relationships. It was Pema Chodron. It was Mary Oliver. It was David White. I started reading a lot of poetry.
In a way, using art, other people's art, to help you with your grief.
Yes.
Or your experience. I don't want to say grief, but
both. Grief is a big part of it. And we shun the concept of grief, or we kind of, I mean, grief is a central part of the human experience. I mean, David White talks about it really beautifully in terms of, you know, we try to avoid heartbreak. And he says, you know, the thing about heartbreak is, I think he describes it as the inevitable consequence of loving anything deeply. Because mm-hmm. everything you love changes, everything you love transforms, even, you know, your kids getting older and moving away is an absolute heartbreak. Your world is torn apart and nothing's gone wrong. And everyone dies, and it's this idea. How do you sit? It's what all the religions try to deal with. You're sitting, you're going to die. Everything you love is going to die. If it doesn't die, it's going to change. And if you don't die first, it'll die right out. You know, it's like,
you're right.
And so we're these gorgeous little sparks that get to experience life for an indeterminable amount of time. There's a guy who came to my singing circles in Santa Barbara who he'd just been diagnosed with bladder cancer and was probably in a pretty deep state of introspection about his mortality. And he tripped and hit his head and instantly died on the sidewalk. Even as he was contemplating his mortality, it came from
something he didn't expect,
a ridiculously random direction, and instantaneously. And we're all dealing with that.
Yeah,
I live in California. We're all waiting for the great earthquake and all the super volcanoes to go again. And we're not in control. And the only thing we're in control of is our reaction to what's around us. And so these songs are much more about, like, how do I use this to wake up instead of going to sleep? I mean, the big issue that I've had, you know, since the divorce is, and I fell in love again very quickly, and kind of, I was so desperate to fall in love. It was about a year after I decided I fell in love, and I kind of was not as cautious and slow as I should have been. I was so ready to be loved again. And it was a very tumultuous relationship, and I've seen you know, a huge dynamic range in that relationship.
Well,
and it's been interesting to be to there's a part of the human psyche that wants to go to sleep, that wants to go, if that's the cost of loving, I'm never going to do it again. I am just going to go to sleep, wait for the bell to ring, try to stay comfortable. And then when, you know, when my ticket gets punched, at least I won't have hurt myself anymore. That's, it's an awful way to live.
Yeah. Glenn, it's amazing to me to think about, and thank you for sharing this. And it's amazing to think about the new record, but then to think about all the Toad records, the Toad the Wet Sprocket records, almost as chapters in your life. And as you said, you started in high school. And to go to the early records, even to the ones that were the monster successes, and even some of the stuff after. Do you see it that way, that they're chapters in your life and the songs reflect where you were in that moment?
Yeah, they're all chapters. And the thing is, my very first chapter, I mean, when I was the age of my oldest daughter, who's 23 now, I had what in the biopic is the... That's the career. That's the end of the story right there. Right. I got famous for a little bit and sold a bunch of records for half a minute. And then my life continued. And I had my struggling years more after my success. And I've had to, you know, most musicians, especially if you were brought up in the major label days when the labels, you know, the CD had come out, but there was still the LP and the cassette. They had more, nobody was pirating. Internet wasn't there. They were so flush with money, happy to start bands on new careers. It was a great time to be signed to a major label. And people will bellyache a lot about what's wrong with the business right now. And there was some part of me that even at the beginning just distrusted the machinations of fame. And, you know, it's this thing of there's this formula for success or whatever, this equation, right?
Right.
And more to question the equation itself about what actually makes a successful life. It's we have so much emphasis on comfort, wealth, status, these other things, and it always comes back to its presence, community, time you spend in nature, time you spend giving, time you spend loving, you know, that.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of, I think, books written on positive attitudes and this kind of idea of the entrepreneurial spirit that leads you to these material gains. And this idea of, you know, if you're not reaching the material gains, that you're somehow not spiritually endowed. And the people I see who are the happiest are not the richest. They occasionally are. They're occasionally incredibly successful people. But they're the incredibly successful people who got incredibly successful by doing what they loved and what was most interesting to them. Right. It's not the people who are wanting to win at any cost. Those people are freaking miserable.
Glenn Phillips, my guest. His new album, Swallowed by the New, just out last year. Of course, the frontman for Toad the Wet Sprocket, which is celebrating their 30th year, or plus, 30 plus, of course. You're at Old Town School tonight. We'll take a quick break. We come back. Get you to perform something?
Yes.
That would be great. Glenn Phillips in studio, Extension 720. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio. Glenn Phillips, Swallowed by the New, is the album. He's at Old Town School of Folk Music tonight. Glenn, you're going to perform for us right now. What are we going to hear?
This one is called Go. It is on the kind of more relational side of the things on the record, but about the... I heard this podcast a while ago that was talking about lighthouses and lighthouses. This is as this analogy for the type of love that instead of saying like, come closer, let me hold you, says, I am casting this light around this perimeter to show you the area you should not go for the benefit of all, because I love you. So,
yeah, all right, great, perfect.
There you go.
Glenn Phillips, here's a song, Go.
Love, your head is down, your eyes are on the floor. No matter what we give, it leaves us wanting more. And you know which way to go.
for all the empty hours and restless afternoons, for all the faded flowers of dreams we spoke too soon. You know which way to go. But there's no harbor here, there's only danger near. Cliffs above and rocks below. And though I want you close, this light can only glow to warn you far away from shore. Saying I love you, now go. Sound in the fog, horn lonely echoes across the bay. And the beacon of the tower lights the way. So you know which way to go. But I won't have another wreck upon my watch. But I can't tell you what to do, I know this much. You know which way to go. But there's no harbor here, there's only danger near. Cliffs above and rocks below. And I don't want to waste your time, but this light can only shine to warn you far away from shore. Saying I love you, now go. Dreaming of your eyes, your mouth, your touch. But I won't have another wreck upon my watch. And you know which way to go.
The song Go, Glenn Phillips, in studio. Shallowed by the New is the record. Toad the Wet Sprocket, out. And about this summer, Glenn Phillips on Extension 720.